All right, couple announcements. Somebody asked me this morning how long they still had to listen to Doran and I talking on this Reformation stuff. And this week and next week is you only have two more weeks of it. And then we go to new Sunday school electives the beginning of December. Those of you who got a bulletin or get a bulletin today on this yellow sheet, they are listed. Steve Hines would appreciate if you would sign up either on the bulletin board out in the hallway or on the website so that he can assign rooms for these various classes. So take a look at that. Others of you have asked about what book we are using to prepare for this study, and that's a hard question because we're just using a variety of sources. But if you wanted to purchase a book for your family, that would cover this general information, especially something you could lead your middle school or high school kids through or have them read, then I would recommend this book, and if you're interested in it, you can write it down. It's called The Church in History, and the author's name is B, as in the letter B, K, and the last name is Kuiper, K-U-I-P-E-R. Okay, this is a fairly simple book to read. It's certainly not at the collegiate level, but it gives you the basics of the things we talked about. And if you have children at home and you're interested in this, this would be a great book for that.
Another book that's useful, and it is at a collegiate level, and it's a book we have in our library, is Christianity Through the Centuries by a guy named Carnes, or C-A-I-R. N.S. Carnes. So, yeah, that's good. That's good.
All right.
You ready to talk?
Go.
Okay.
Oh, wait. Oh, hold up. Just a second. All right. So, you either had a new timeline from Bob today, or some of you, which I was impressed with, still had your old timeline. If you have your old timeline, we are on the back page on the bottom where you see the rise of the Puritans and Separatists. If you got a new one today, it would be this bottom timeline. That's where we will be today. All right, okay. Doran.
So in 1490, a guy named Thomas Lineker, he was an academic at Oxford. He was, of course, as all academics at the time, very religious and very involved in just the study of the text. And so Lineker decided, you know what, I've been reading this Latin version of the scriptures that had been passed down from the Catholic Church, and I think I want to go back and pick up the Greek text and take a look at it. Now, of course, he knew Greek. And it was just kind of funny back then. Those guys, man, their mastery of language was just really good. Lineker made a comment. As he read it, he noticed a huge difference in the original Greek text and the Latin. And so he made a statement that was to go down in history. And we don't study Lineker in this class just simply because we don't have the time. But an interesting guy. Lineker made the comment. He said, either this is not the gospel or we are not Christians. Because this Latin Bible that I've been reading is way, way different than the Greek text. And in a lot of ways, that started this ball rolling. And I know we've been over these years ad nauseum. In a sense, we've been studying for the entirety of this course. We've been studying sort of a couple of hundred-year period and then going forward. And it's almost like we're going layers on this. And so I had wanted to talk about the origin of the English Bible a little bit because we're transitioning into talking about American Puritanism. And all of this stuff becomes very, very important. So, 1517, we have the Reformation starting. 1536, we have William Tyndale being martyred, you know, strangled and then burned at the stake. And remember his last words. We talked about them a few weeks ago. Anybody remember his last words? God, please open the eyes of the king. Who's the king? Henry VIII. Henri to his friends. So, what's interesting is this. 1536, William Tyndale's killed. 1539, Henry VIII approves an English Bible to be printed. 3 years later. That's a good prayer request, right? And so what we have here is the establishment of what's called the Great Bible. Now, many of you, because we talked about this a few weeks ago, the Great Bible becomes the first approved English version in the Church of England. And just so you know, the Church of England steers biblical translation up until about the 1800s. They are the guys who produce, in essence, a push towards translation. And that's why when we look forward, so Henry VIII dies, then we have Elizabeth, and in 1604, James I becomes king, and in 1611, we have the King James Version. Now, I want you to understand, the Great Bible is the first English translation. However, as we had pointed out last week in some discussion, we also have concurrent to it is the Geneva Bible. Now, what's interesting is the Geneva Bible and the Great Bible are both worked on by a guy named Miles Coverdale. How many of you have ever had the Coverdale Bible? A couple of you. And actually, it should be noted that the Great Bible and the Geneva Bible have about 90% of the text is about the same. And actually, along that score, these two Bibles become the seed for, well, these three Bibles. There's also a separate translation of the Coverdale Bible. But the Coverdale Bible, the Great Bible, and the Geneva Bible are all using William Tyndale's Bible as sort of the pod form. All of that informs upon the 1611, which is why in 1604 they start the process of creating a new translation, and it's already in print by 1611. As an aside, occasionally you'll come across people who say, the 1611 is the only Bible, the King James Bible is the only good Bible. And frankly, people who say that are ignorant. They don't know what they're talking about. There's a guy named Al Lacey a few years ago who actually postulated that the English versions had already become corrupted, but God sent a second work of His Holy Spirit in 1611 to reclaim the text from the original. He's a fool, ladies and gentlemen, a foolish, foolish man. That is just stupid stuff that people say. And actually, those who advocate for the 1611 aren't actually reading the 1611. They're reading the 1769 and the 1785 revisions. They kept the cover page for the 1611 because they were afraid it was going to hurt sales if they changed it to a revised 1769 version. And so they left. It's not the 1611. 1611 actually contains the apocryphal books. And I don't think anybody's advocating for that. So anyway, all of this happens. Now, what's interesting is the Geneva Bible, which is virtually the same as the Coverdale Bible, virtually the same as the Tyndale Bible, virtually the same as the later King James Bible, virtually the same as the Great Bible approved by the Church of England. The Geneva Bible gets pushed out of favor by about 1660. The reason is because the Geneva Bible and all of these Bibles also have a political element to them. And I want you to understand, Bible translation was as much a push of politics as it was a Reformation reclamation of the text. It really was. And so the Geneva Bible makes a bunch of statements that, you know, the Pope is the Antichrist, which becomes a point of doctrine in a lot of Reformed churches. I think it was a huge mistake. I don't think it's particularly helpful. And so the Geneva Bible had all this commentary on the side, which was just vociferous against the Catholic Church. Well, I don't know if you know British people, but British people are somewhat offended by anybody making harsh statements. Now, did you have your hand up as a question?
Tyndale used, what did he use to translate?
He used Erasmus, he used the Greek and the Hebrew, as well as the Latin. Now, Erasmus had done a reclamation work. He also used Lineker's work. And so that's actually one of the things that I just push for like crazy. Okay, so, and we don't want to get into this, but there are two schools of thought on scripture translation. One of those is called Textus Receptus. And Textus Receptus was the particular bent that I was taught from when I was in seminary. And Textus Receptus says we're going to take all of the texts that we have. And that's one of the things that we really need to understand is that, you know, Geneva Bible's good translation, 1611, good translation. But I actually prefer the New American Standard, which is an offshoot of the American Standard from 1901. The reason is because we have compiled a lot more of the text since Tyndale and these guys were translated. They really didn't have that much access to the original materials, nor a bunch of them. But they had a good pocket of them. That pocket is called Textus Receptus. There's also another school of thought called critical text, and critical text says, let's identify the best text that we have and translate from there. Textus Receptus says, let's do majority rules. It's very democratic in that way. And so I actually don't hold to one school or the other, but see points of benefit to both schools. I'm one of those classic middle-of-the-road guys who can't seem to care about a lot of stuff. And so, that's what he's translating from. Yes, sir, Mark. Yeah, those are called critical texts.
What's your opinion of their actors?
Okay, my opinion is, I don't know if that captures. That's sort of my opinion.
Well, that's a complete answer.
I know it's not a complete answer, but what I feel on that is that I can understand the point of view of saying, can we identify the best texts possible? And in points of real contention, let that determine. Well, Textus Receptus, you know, that's the version I was taught from. Textus Receptus says majority rules. And actually, if I can be boastful about my possessions for a moment, I actually have a copy of Textus Receptus Greek text in my library, as well as a critical text, because I'm ecumenical that way. But yeah, I don't really care. And the thing is that, you know, I've been involved in these discussions, and when I was taking Greek and all that stuff, I worked through all those texts, and these theologians would get really fired up, textual critics especially, they get really fired up about the argument of one reading to another, and I would look at the substance of their argument and look at the substance of what they were fighting about. And I'd go, okay, I don't think there's an issue here. It's not that big a deal. I mean, we're talking about minor differences between texts, and we're talking about handwritten copies. So, yeah, you're going to have some weird typos. You're going to have some strange things that happen, even in multi-print books, massive print books that go through a rigorous editing process. We still have typos. You're going to have typos in handwritten texts that are passed down through a chain of hands and various degrees of scholarship and various degree of care taken to of them. I have a tough time getting really exercised about it. Yeah. Yes, but no Bible translation comes only from Greek or Hebrew or Aramaic. It also comes from later translations of those texts. So even the Masoretic text of the Old Testament is informed, the modern Masoretic text that we have of the Old Testament is informed by the Aramaic translation from the Targum.
I don't remember who you said it was, this man said that
It's the various stages of translations that were various copies that were handed through. So it's not the Vulgate is a better original copy or translation than the later Catholic, because remember they're passing those down through a chain, and as the monks come against stuff, they are changing stuff. And actually, if you have an old King James Bible, what's done in Hebrews chapter 1 is nothing like what you find in a modern King James of Hebrews 1. You'll see big differences in there. You're going, whoa, what's going on? And it's because the translators wanted to clarify things that they thought were clear in their minds but weren't really clear in the text. In the same way, you know, NIV, I point this out all the time with NIV people. People love NIV. NIV in Hebrews 11, they change Sarah. In the original text, Sarah is used as an example of faith. And they go, we don't like Sarah. And so they changed it to Abraham. They mentioned Sarah, but they get the focus off Sarah. That's in Hebrews 11:11. And if you look at NAS or King James or any of those things of Hebrews 11:11, and then you look at an NIV, you'll become alarmed because you're like, these verses are nothing alike. And it's just simply because translators really struggle with staying objective. And as they come to a translation, they really want to make it clear. And that's where that brings us back to our point, is that all of these translations were political documents. They really were. And when you just look at the text, Geneva Bible, the King James, the Tyndale, the Coverdale, to later translations, they're all very, very similar. And actually, the Geneva Bible, to this day, it fell out of print, I think, 1644. And so Geneva Bible went out of print forever. But even these modern sort of reclamations of the Geneva Bible, it's about 90% William Tyndale's translation. And this is a thing I also point out, is you don't have to worry about your English translation. Any English translation you pick up is a really good translation that has stood the test of time. And it's inarguable that the New American Standard is the absolute most accurate word-for-word translation. But yeah, it loses some readability. But even NIV, which I don't particularly use, is a very good English translation. It's very good. Its translation of the Old Testament is better than its New Testament translation. But when I translate from original text, it always comes out New King James. So if you read a New King James, it's actually a Doran translation. Every time I translate, it always comes out New King James. I have no idea why. It just is. And it's almost word for word every time. Yeah. But they really aren't, in that it's a whole pool of documents that go into it. Nobody is pulling from one source. All of these guys are pulling from a bunch of sources when they translate. Every English Bible, even the New World Translation, which is the Jehovah's Witness translation, it's a good English translation of the Bible. And this is one of those things, too, is I have argued for years against the grain that really, you aren't gaining that much by studying Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic, all three languages. I've studied greatly, and I find that they are not much of an advantage. The fact is, if you're reading your Bible in English, you're almost just as equipped as anybody familiar in the original languages. These are great translations. You're in really good shape. You don't have to worry. They're wonderful. No, I still encourage you. No, I'm not modifying. I still encourage you. Learn Greek, learn some Hebrew. But you're not, you know, and I don't argue from the text much for the original Greek or Hebrew. Once in a while it makes a difference, and it's my whole thing on technical versus general words. And at some point maybe I'll put that on paper so that everybody can understand it. But yeah, you're fine. You're really fine. Yeah. Are you talking about the Greek Hebrew, the Greek Key Study Bible? That Greek Key Study Bible, well, it would find itself in the majority of view on the use of the languages with a vast majority of preachers and teachers of Old Testament who are professionals. It would find itself, to some degree, askance with me. And it just depends. Do you trust all those guys or do you trust me? Anyway, that's horrible. That's a horrible statement. Anyway. All right. Does this get us far enough to do what we want to do?
I think so.
Okay. Go ahead, David. Talk.
All right. Well, thanks for the opening.
You're welcome.
All right. So, appropriately enough, today we want to talk a little bit about pilgrims or as they were known in England, the Separatists. So we'll call what we call pilgrims, we'll call them Separatists for the rest of the...
Also nonconformists.
Nonconformists. Okay, so during this time, through the 1500s, those of you who know the history know that England went back and forth between being a Catholic country and a Protestant country. And it's almost like watching a tennis match, you know.
Schizophrenic.
The ball's in one court and they're Catholic, and the ball's hit over the net and they're Protestant. And every time the ball goes over a net, another 50,000 people die. You know, it was incredibly bloody time. Unbelievable lack of tolerance of anything. Very rigid mindsets. Of course, what's happening is that there's this natural yearning to break away from Catholicism by a lot of people who have been influenced by Calvin in Geneva. And what you have is the Pope, the Church, and especially France and the King of France really trying to exercise a lot of authority from afar to manipulate England to maintain its Catholic leanings. And as Dorn said, and as we've talked before, remember that in this time, this is hard for us in America to really get a handle on, but it's as much political as it is religious. The King of France is Catholic. Yes, he's there to defend the church and support the church. The King of France wants England to be Catholic as much to quell or squash this idea of people's thoughts and individual freedoms, because an authoritarian like the King of France feels that Reformation is going to cause political upheaval, not just religious upheaval. So the politics and religion were so intertwined that you absolutely can't dissect them apart in this time.
Oh, go ahead. Keep talking.
All right. So we have the pilgrims coming to America in 1620. The pilgrims are the Separatists, the nonconformists. They felt that they could no longer live within the what we would know as the Anglican Church, and they wanted things changed in the Anglican Church, things that they were just really bothered by. Now, when we hear some of this, we think, holy cow, you people were really, you know, wound a little tight about some things. But, you know, the things that they really were concerned about, the order of service in an Anglican church, was that even though it was Protestant, they kneeled to take communion. And the Separatists or the nonconformists felt like that was giving too much credit to communion, almost like the Catholics did, where there was the transubstantiation of the elements.
Well, they viewed it as iconoclastic.
Yeah.
That it was a worship of the elements.
Of the elements, right. And so they didn't want to kneel for communion. They didn't want to celebrate Christmas or Easter. They were still doing infant baptism, but they didn't want the person who was performing the infant baptism to do the sign of the cross at baptism, which was a traditional thing. They also were really hung up about the clerics or the preachers of the Anglican Church changing their dress with the seasons and having this official clerical type dress. It reminded them too much of the Catholic Church.
The investment crisis.
Yes.
And I don't like what the preacher's wearing.
Right.
Right.
Right. And more importantly, this is really interesting. They were also demanding that each church have the pastor chosen by the people, not given to them by some sort of hierarchy of the church. And now this is the first time this thought comes forward, that each church have an elected set of elders who would maintain the discipline of the church. Okay, so this is what the Puritans demanded. The Puritans were this reform movement within the English church, the English Protestant church. And when some of the Puritans got so frustrated that things weren't changing fast enough, they moved into this separatist or nonconformist camp. Eventually, they went to Holland for a while, or the Netherlands, and then they came back to England and went to America. So in 1620, we have the Pilgrims coming to America and founding the Plymouth Colony. Interestingly enough, though, in 1629, 9 years later, we have Puritans coming to America and founding the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And so both the Separatists who came in 1620, which we celebrate on Thanksgiving, and then later the Puritans, both came to America to try to start in this new promised land and practice the kind of religion they thought. So the Puritans and the Separatists were not satisfied with moving away from Catholicism and having Protestantism. Even within Protestantism, they were feeling that we hadn't gone far enough.
Yeah, and so this is sort of where that discussion of the Bible comes back. Because you have these English translations popping up. The Geneva Bible, truly, for 100 years, is the most popular Bible. And the reason for that is not textual issues. The text from English translation to English translation is virtually the same. However, the marginal notes in the Geneva Bible are anti-Catholic and also specifically anti-divine right of kings. And so England is concerned about those extreme statements. First of all, because by the 1640s, of course, we come into a crisis with Charles I, who did believe in the divine right of kings and preached that as a political philosophy. And so the Puritans, who are sort of slowly finding themselves more and more marginalized and out of favor, by about 1600, are still very tied to the Geneva Bible with its anti-Catholic flavor. However, as the Great Bible, you know, the Great Bible is mostly just a plain text that adopts most of the Geneva Bible's translation, but it's just plain text without commentary. And so as we come into the 1611, where the King James Bible is then pushed, the King James Bible is just an updated version, which in some ways, in some places, is closer to the Geneva Bible. But that itself becomes a political statement where we say, hey, we're still reading the same Bible as these guys, but we don't have all this anti-Catholic, anti-government stuff in it. And so from 1611 to about 1640, you see a declining Geneva Bible interest as people kind of go to the main text. But that has a lot to do with the English disfavor or the English personality of not liking extreme statements. And I know we wanted to touch on the Arminian crisis a little bit today because John Owen and, of course, Oliver Cromwell are part of that. But what's interesting is that the Puritans are leaving England by 1620, and that has as much to do with the Bible as it does with the politics of the day. But as they're leaving England, you know, 1620, but then by 1640s, Puritanism is in vogue in England. And Oliver Cromwell is perfectly allowed to hold office and to exercise in the gentry and to be a guy of means and power, and yet he's a Puritan.
So
that's just fascinating, yeah?
Yeah, and so we talked last week a lot about how the Reformation affected the American experiment and mm-hmm. the founding of America. And one other thing, since you brought up Charles I, that again, to me, is the way the Reformation affects. I mean, here we have this battle between absolute power of the king and whatever religion he wants to enforce, and the Puritans, ultimately, in the English Parliament at the time. Mm-hmm. And so, eventually, the Puritans, as you say, get power in England, and they actually take Charles I to the scaffold, and they chop his head off.
Right.
And that just sent shockwaves around the world, because never in the history of mankind had an anointed king
right.
been held accountable to the people in which he was over which he was ruling.
Right, and that's especially radical in England, where everybody just goes along to get along.
Right.
And the idea of regicide
right.
would have been, that's the least likely place you would see that happen, and yet there it happened.
Right. Now, I mean, if a brother decided to kill his brother who was king,
sure.
that's one thing. That's
right.
still in the royal family.
Right.
But for this rabble down here...
To rise up,
right. hold a ruler accountable for his actions in a religious sort of way, and actually sentence him, have a trial sentence him, and put him to death was just remarkable. Nothing had ever happened in the world like that
right.
before.
Do we have time for a personal story?
Well, it seems like we do.
Oh. So. Well, I don't want to push.
No.
So anyway, when we were in England a couple of years ago, we went to the banquet hall at Whitehall, which is the only part of the palace of Whitehall that's left.
Right.
And so when you walk into the banquet hall at Whitehall, which is an amazing structure, the ceiling are these enormous panels painted by Rubens depicting Charles I as the anointed of God sitting on the throne,
mm-hmm.
right? And they actually have a bunch of beanbags sitting around on the floor so you can lay down and look at the ceiling. And so it's this room that states unequivocally the divine right from God of the king to rule. And yet Charles I was dragged outside and was actually tried right outside the doors
of Whitehall
before they marched him across town to kill him.
Yeah.
I mean, you see that when you stand there and you're like, these two philosophies, one is the philosophy of the street and the other is this philosophy of this banquet hall. It's shocking
mm-hmm.
to say we wept like children. We didn't, but anyway.
Don't get carried away. Yeah. All right. But that is another, that idea of the Puritans in the mid-1600s, and then we come to the founding of America, mm-hmm. that, you know, the Declaration of Independence, we are holding a sovereign accountable for his actions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he does not have an absolute right to rule.
Right.
And those thoughts actually start back here in the mid-1600s.
And they are radical thoughts.
Very radical thoughts, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you do see sort of that, it's a seed of rebellion that I think at some point crosses the line scripturally.
Okay.
But you also do see the idea that the master is not without accountability.
Exactly.
And it's an amazing dynamic.
To me, there is value in that thought.
Mm-hmm.
That,
well, and yeah. you could even say that the Geneva Bible becomes the seed of that, because the Geneva Bible in its marginal notes is throwing off the right of the church to dictate the affairs of man. And so in a sense, that Bible, which is the first Bible in America, and it becomes sort of the seed of American founding, even though the only Bible to be officially recognized by the Congress is the King James Bible. And it was the Bible preferred by George Washington. So if you like the Geneva Bible, you like the Puritans. If you like the King James Bible, you like George Washington. And it's no more complex than that. No, that's an offhand joke. But.
So anyhow, you will see in your handout or your timeline that we passed out today, or that you had, you can see where Cromwell is indicated there. And this time of the Long Parliament and the Westminster Assembly, these are times when the Puritans actually hold sway in England. But unfortunately, Cromwell dies, and he has not done leadership development well, and there's no one to take his place that is adequate or up to the task of ruling.
Now, can I interrupt here? Do you have a positive view of Cromwell?
Yeah, I do.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't so much have a positive view of Cromwell.
Well, I don't think that his later years were very good when he decided to make a military dictatorship out of England, but I wasn't going to go into that.
Well, I think it may be useful to just give a brief here of the radical change, because you're right. You know,
I think early on Cromwell was a very positive force, but I don't think that later in life he was. So there's.
Now, I have a mixed view on that.
Okay.
Yeah, because, okay, so we have.
Should we discuss it now or not?
I don't know. What time is it? Okay, so yeah, Cromwell, if you want to say 1642, we have the Civil War. The First Civil War, which is followed by a Second Civil War. And in the 1640s, we have two things happening. One is the Westminster Confession. Now, the Westminster Confession forms the basis for Reformed or Reformation Calvinistic type doctrine to become a part of the Church of England. Now, that's a radical shift. Remember, that way back here, in the 1500s, when Henry VIII is king, right? Mid-1500s, Henry VIII is king, and he wants to create the Anglican Church, but he wants an Anglican Church that is a mirror image of the Catholic Church. No changes. No changes in doctrine, no changes in any of its view on Scripture, not even really a change in its Bible, although in 1539, he allows for the Great Bible, and that becomes the first approved translation.
The absolute only difference is he controls it instead of the Pope.
Right.
That's the only difference.
Okay, so then, okay, so we'll say that's 1550, right, when that's happening. By 1640, we have a complete upheaval where Westminster Confession occurs, where Westminster is not only ditching the whole Catholic notion and the Catholic Arminianism and semi-Pelagianism, but they are actually adopting Reformation doctrine. So at the same time that Westminster's going on, the English Civil War is going on, and then by 1649, Charles I is executed, and the Protectorate under Cromwell occurs in the 1650s. And what you have, I mean, in that short amount of time, you're talking about a huge societal change where the church is adopting the Reformation in doctrine and practice only 1.5 generations after Henry VIII sitting there trying to recreate the Catholic Church. I mean, it is unprecedented, and it just shows you God's hand in it, and it's not perfect. I mean, David's right. It is a bloody time. People die. But Henry VIII's last wife was Catherine Parr, who was a Protestant. She's actually Calvinistic in her doctrine.
After 8 times, he finally gets it right. You know, he marries a Protestant.
Yeah, but they were only married 5 years.
Yeah.
And then he dies, and she was married less than a year after, and then she dies. It's just a mess.
So I wanted to, moving beyond Cromwell, another thing, for those of you who have Scottish background or in your family or are Presbyterian, have a Presbyterian background, what is just hard to believe is after Cromwell and the Puritans have this time of ruling in England, we go back to rulers that favor an Anglican church.
Mm-hmm.
And they are dead set against the reformers in Scotland. And we talked a couple weeks ago about John Knox, the Presbyterian form of government and all this. So by the late 1600s, and this is not listed on your timeline, but in that time of Charles II there, the Anglican Church actually goes after the Presbyterians in Scotland. And for those of you who have studied in the past about the Covenanters, those are the people in Scotland who belong to a Presbyterian form of, and they were literally hunted like animals. I mean, it was actually sport. You just cannot fathom the mindset of people. They're both Protestants now. It's no longer Catholic versus Protestants in a way, although you can say the Anglican Church is close to Catholicism. But the Anglicans went to Scotland with the purpose of absolutely destroying the Covenanters. And they were really oppressed, killed in the fields, driven from their parishes. Several thousand pastors were put out of work and were just completely lost their livelihoods, families destroyed. Some of you would recognize the name of John Bunyan, who wrote what? Pilgrim's Progress. John Bunyan was a Covenanter that was put in jail for 12 years by the Anglicans during this time in which he wrote Pilgrim's Progress. Some of you may know the name of John Milton, Paradise Lost. John Milton was a Covenanter, was put in jail at this time from the Anglicans. So those men and those great works from those men came from this time where it was no longer Catholic on Protestant violence, but really Protestants fighting each other over the form, because the king had demanded a certain order of worship, and if you decided you didn't want to follow that order of worship out of a conscience issue, the death penalty was on your head.
Right, and so the Westminster Confession, the political aim of the Westminster Confession, once again, 1642.
Before we had what I was just talking about.
Right. The political aim of the Westminster Confession was to get the Scottish people on board for being anti-king. They didn't want Charles I, and so that was a way of bringing that Scottish Reformation movement up under Church of England.
Yep.
So Church of England was willing to compromise its doctrine partially as a means of getting the Scots on board.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, after Cromwell, the sort of that hatred, and this is why I have a negative view on Cromwell, because Cromwell overplayed his hand.
He did.
And as a result of that, the lashback was that instead of now really looking for truth and moderation, the lashback, well, let's get rid of everything that looks and smells Reformation. And so that meant Scotsmen. Let's kill as many Scottish people as we can. And that's why the Scots were pro Charles II. Let's restore the monarchy. Let's just do a do-over. Let's go back to where we started so we don't have all this stuff anymore. And that was a big push there.
So again, part of the when you really look at and you'll never read this in a secular history book, but to my mind, again, bringing Reformation themes into America and the history of America, what we know that the Scotch-Irish were happy to join the American Revolution on the rebellion side, as Doran would say, because they hated the English from their homeland, and they were willing to fight the English, whether on the old, on the mother country or the new world. You know, they would be willing to fight the English. And part of that goes back to all of these civil wars that occurred in England and Scotland over these years. And a lot of it happened over religion that had been intertwined so tightly with politics.
Right, yeah.
And that then all of those, all of that history and all of that ill will comes to the New World and helps to fuel the passions of the American Revolution as well.
And I think you can make a good argument, maybe we'll get there this week, and I, actually I'm not displeased with where we are in our timeline, because we're going to be closing out with the Reformation as it kind of winds down into the Great Awakenings. But you could make an argument that really what we see in the American Revolution is an extension of the Reformation movement. You can make an argument there. I wouldn't say it's necessarily accurate, but it's certainly plausible.
Well, there's tenets or strains of it, for
there
sure.
There are tenets and strains of it, which really you can argue that the American Revolution was unavoidable based on the Reformation history of the mid-1600s in England. And maybe that's where we'll go next week.
Okay, we could do that. So our point is that it was more than a tax on tea.
It was more than a tax on tea.
Yeah.
And so maybe we'll get to John Owen. I know we had wanted to talk about John Owen a little bit. But
and Jacob Arminius.
Jacob Arminius.
We'll talk about that next week as we try to put a cap on everything.
Sure. Yeah, very. Yeah.
All right, any comments or questions?
Next week's class will be 3.5 hours long.
All right. Good.
More paper to write on. Okay. All right. Any last minute questions?
Yeah.
Comments? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Scofield Bible is what it's known for is that it recreates an eschatology that isn't necessarily biblical. Yeah, I don't know if I'd go that far with it in its influence. I think R.C. Sproul speaks a lot on this, on sort of the rampant semi-Pelagianism, which can be somewhat like Arminianism. Rampant semi-Pelagianism that infects American churches, but I think that has more to do with sort of the idea of Americans of self-determinism and independence than it necessarily has to do with the influence of biblical texts. I think it has more to do with a personality trait. In a sense, I think rebellion is bred into us as Americans.
I think what Josh is asking is because we had all this reformed movement in the United States that we've talked about so far. We haven't really talked about Arminianism yet.
Yeah.
But he's saying, is the Scofield Bible responsible for moving from a reformed view of eschatology to a more dispensational view of eschatology? I'm interpreting.
Oh, it's certainly that. Mm-hmm. Certainly that. Mm. Yeah, late 1800s, early 20th century.
I think that might be giving it too much credit.
A little bit too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
I'm curious, was there a significant portion of the Scots who were in favor of Anglicanism?
Yeah, it's, evangelicalism is always a mixed bag. But yeah, I mean, Mark, you've asked a complicated question. Are the Scots univocally against Anglicanism? No. But a lot of that is for different reasons. Part of it's driven by money and politics. Part of it's driven by truly a link to the Church of England and sort of that idea of trusting Mother Church. A lot of people don't like the idea of congregationalism. Don't like the idea of local elders. That small government, local type thing really freaks some people out.
Remember that the nobles and the ruling class of Scotland were very much in favor of being allied with the ruling class of England. And so what we've talked about with the Presbyterianism and all of that was not from that level of society. So not everyone in Scotland was in favor of Presbyterianism.
Well, and also remember, just like today, if you want to go to college, you're going to be taught from an Anglican point of view. You're going to be taught from the religion of the state point of view. And so if you had any money and you wanted your kid to go to Oxford, you had to sort of ally yourself with the Church of England, and that in itself is its own indoctrination. But anyway, we got to quit. So let me pray. Father, we do thank you for the day. We just ask that you will bless the worship to follow and help us to learn lessons, that we not recreate mistakes of the past, but truly walk in the light of your word. It's in your name we pray. Amen. See you at church.